This is not psychotherapy. Dr. Wills does not have a provider-patient relationship with this guest. These are just two people talking about emotions.
Welcome to Give a F*** Actually, with your host, Dr. Alex Wills.
Episode of Give a F Actually. I'm here with Dr. Timothy Golden. He is a visiting professor of philosophy at Wilton College in Walla Walla, Washington, or soon to be. When he's not working as an academic philosopher, he is a criminal defense attorney and an actor, having performed classical and contemporary theater, including works by Shakespeare, August Wilson, and George Stevens, Juniors Thurgood. Dr. Golden is also a survivor of emotional abuse and encourages people to constructively engage their emotions in the interest of their well-being, which he does in part through his work as co-host of the Motown Philly podcast. Does that all sound right?
It does sound right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Welcome to the show. You're quite the Renaissance man. Philosophy, acting, defense attorney. There's a lot going on there.
Yes. Yes. I have a lot going on. I think my identity is complex, and that just means that I was made to do difficult things. So I have to do a lot of things, and I try to do all of them well. I certainly hope I do them well, and hope that in the end, I will have left the world in a little bit of a better condition than when I found it.
So, professor of philosophy, tell me how that came to be. What is that like? Is that one of your callings?
Okay, so yes, Alex, so professor of philosophy, how it came to be was that I was an undergraduate and I took a philosophy class, and the class that I took was Intro to Philosophy, and the professor had us read Plato's Republic from start to finish. And
okay.
I was hooked on philosophy at that point. Now, I was majoring in something else. As an undergraduate, I majored in criminal justice, and I was pretty far along when I discovered philosophy. I was a junior, and so I took as many philosophy classes as I could without formally declaring a major, because there were language requirements and other things. And I was probably about maybe 12 credits shy of a major. But I pretty much was at the end of college and I had to graduate. And I told myself that if I ever had the opportunity, that one day I would go back and get a PhD in philosophy. Well, I graduated. I went off to law school. I practiced law for about 12 years and was on the verge of burnout. And at the time, I was married at the time. And my spouse and I decided that it would be a good idea for me to go back to graduate school and to try to become a college professor. And fortunately, all of that worked out. And that's what I ended up doing. I went back, I got a PhD in philosophy, and here I am. So that's how it came about. And it is a sense in which I think it is a vocation of mine. It is a sort of calling. So I'm very at home doing it. And I can't believe that I'd actually get paid to do this. It's really incredible. I'm very glad for the opportunity to be an academic philosopher.
Yeah, that's the best job to have, where you can't, you know, you do it anyway, even if you weren't getting paid. Kind of like my podcast right now. I'm making zero money off of this, but it's a work of passion.
Sure.
So this podcast is all about emotions, and the category of emotions that a lot of people don't think about is desires. So what desires, what preferences, what wishes do you have that kind of philosophy, or being a professor, a teacher of philosophy, help you to fulfill?
That's a really great question. For me, it's the desire to think, the desire to reflect, the desire to reflect critically. The desire to play a role in the world, not unlike the role of Socrates in ancient Athens, that is the role of a gadfly, a desire to see people think beneath the surface, to encourage people to think beneath the surface, to make sure I think beneath the surface. And to do that, to do all those things with clarity and precision, always understanding that as important as reason is, reason also has its limitations. And so the limitations of reason are where I like to say the language of propositions or logic, which is so useful to us every day, reaches a point where it exhausts itself. And we move from propositions to poetry. When we feel bad, when our dog dies, or when we go through a breakup, or if there's some bad news in our lives, we're not interested in hearing an argument. Sometimes we just want to hear a song. We want to hear a poem, right? And I think I'm a big believer that reason and the emotions are not necessarily opposed to one another, but that they work together to form the human person. And reason is useful in its sphere. We need logic. Goodness knows we need logic nowadays. We need logic. We have to accept certain basic notions of propositional truth that help us to get along in the world. But we also have to understand that propositional truth has its limitations, and that on the other side of that is another dimension to human life that demands a different sort of expression, an emotional expression that often shows up in art, all forms of art, poetry, music, poetry and music together, and song and so forth. And so I think for me, philosophy induces within me the desire to help make these connections clear so that people can realize you don't have to make a choice between reason and the emotions. Reason and the emotions work together. And when their relationship is rightly understood, that's when I think we have healthy people. And that's when I think we have a better world that appreciates art and works of art because of their deep connection to human emotions as much as it appreciates the truths of the natural sciences, physics, biology, chemistry, etc. So I have a real desire to help make these things clear. And that's part of my way of helping to make the world a better place, or trying to make the world a better place.
That gives me chills. That's very well said. And I love that phrase, from propositions to poetry. Yeah. And I came to sort of a similar conclusion, being interested in logic and philosophy and sort of noticing the limits of that, and my interest in emotions and trying to explore the value of those, in addition to work together with reason, has sort of led me to where I'm at right now, because I think of emotions as kind of our sixth sense, where they give us some priceless data that we really can't get from our other five senses. Now, our interpretation of that data may be on or off, but nevertheless, I think it's valuable and meaningful. And oftentimes, we really can only kind of get to the depths of it through art and music, artistic expression, and receiving of that. So that's so wonderful that you've also come to those conclusions.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah, I really believe that the nature of human beings is so incredibly complex that to reduce it to either just logic or just art, I think is shortchanging both, because I teach logic, right? I teach symbolic logic. So it's thinking at a very high level of abstraction. I tell my students that logic is to human thought what the skeletal system is to the human body. If you imagine a human body without a skeleton, it would just sort of be an unintelligible blob of stuff, right? Covered in skin. You'd have eyeballs rolling around. you know, you'd have organs that are essentially vital organs left unprotected, right? But when you hang all of that into structure, now what was once unintelligible becomes recognizable. And now the things that are so valuable to us are our eyes, our heart, our lungs, our liver, our kidneys. Now all of those things are protected. And logic sort of serves that function for us. But again, it takes us very far, and it's necessary, but it only takes us so far. And so just on the other side of that is this wonderful dimension of human experience that that comes from the emotions. And I think that's where we find art in just about all of its forms.
Okay. That's really a helpful analogy to think of it that way. I want to talk to you about so many things because you've got so much going on. The thing that really made me interested in speaking with you is I was introduced to your work through your TED Talk that kind of blew up and got out there. I was sort of on a personal quest looking for more folks that had some newer insights and thoughts to emotional abuse, particularly emotional abuse experienced by men, oftentimes from their partner. And I work with a lot of patients. In particular, an example is folks married with neurotypical and neurodivergent couples, where one of the partners has Asperger's, high-functioning autism, or for whatever other reason, there seems to be some emotional abuse going on. So I wanted to dive in a little bit more, hear a little bit about your story, what kind of inspired you to do the TED Talk. If you wanted to maybe give us a little bit of background about that, and then also after you did the TED Talk, what happened after that? What kind of doors opened? How has your life changed since that happened for you?
Thank you very much, Alex. Well, what led to the TED Talk was a marriage that was fundamentally unhealthy, and it was abusive. The abusive behavior sort of continued in my marriage, but it didn't begin in my marriage. Like most of us, we have events that happen to us in childhood that compromise us, often without us even realizing just how much we've been compromised. And for me, when I was growing up, that compromise happened through an abusive relationship with an older sibling. And in that context, what I did was, as a kid growing up, I sort of believed everything that my older sibling, my older brother, told me. I believed all of it. I believed that I was fat, that I was stupid, that I couldn't talk well. As a kid, I had a bad speech impediment, and I used to stutter, and I believed all of those things. And believing all of those things led to a compromise in my disposition toward women. And so what would happen was, as a kid growing up, now I think I'm probably around the age of, you know, 12, between 12 and 14, when you start liking girls and wanting to have a girlfriend. But of course, I held all these very limiting beliefs about myself. And so I thought, well, the only way to get a woman interested in me is to sort of let her do whatever she wants, because she's not going to accept me because I believe all these terrible things about myself. I believe them to be true. And so my disposition toward women and toward romantic relationships was already compromised. And that was the attitude that I pretty much had going into my marriage, which was the only way I'm going to get to keep her around is if I allow her to do whatever she wants to do or say whatever she wants to say. And so we got married. Now, so I'm already compromised, right? Going into the marriage. Right. And then during the marriage, that difficulty I had was sort of exploited throughout the marriage. And a lot of the same narratives that plagued me in childhood plagued me during the marriage. And these were narratives about me being fat and unattractive. And I can't believe that I can't believe that I'm married to this beautiful woman, and oh, she wants me. And so there's a lot of that in turn gave way to a lot of codependency, to a lot of seeking after her approval, pushing for her to accept me. And what would happen during the marriage is that there would be these periods of time, and many of your listeners will know this, and you know this too, Alex, that in an abusive relationship, one of the hallmarks of it is that it is not always abusive, right? It is that there are times when the abused person feels comfortable and feels like everything is okay. And then all of a sudden, there's an abusive episode. And during the marriage, these episodes would take the form of a silent treatment followed by behavior toward me that was hostile, things being said to me, such as, I don't understand why you don't just do this. If you just lost weight and made yourself more attractive, you know, we wouldn't have this problem. You wouldn't make me so mad if you just lost weight. How many times have we heard a male abuser say that to a woman after he's hit her? If you wouldn't make me so mad, then I wouldn't hit you, right? That was the sort of abuse that took place between my ex-wife and I. And it just got to the point where I was with her for 21 years. I was married to her for 19 years. We were engaged 2 years prior to that. And so you can imagine with these episodes occurring on a regularity and me continuing to tell myself that I wasn't good enough, the damage that had been done to my sense of self-worth and self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the marriage and my understanding of marriage generally is occurring in a fairly conservative religious community in which divorce is frowned upon and where men in particular are told to identify with the Christ figure in a way that tells them they must suffer and die for the salvation of their spouse and their family. So I'm being fed a narrative about Christian manhood that is further exacerbating an already deeply compromised sense of self-worth. And that led me to the brink of suicide. It led me to a place in which I really thought that I was going to be better off dead than remaining in a marriage that hurt me so much, because I couldn't get divorced, because if I got divorced, then I would bring scorn and humiliation and shame on myself, and I would be ostracized from the community. And so all of that came together to the point where I was just a few weeks away from taking my own life. And what frightened me to therapy was the fact that I actually took comfort in the thought of my own death. It was pleasant to think about not being around anymore, because I wouldn't have to deal with this pain. And so it was at that point that I began to think critically about my own symptoms, my hyper attentiveness to my ex-wife, the fact that I was on eggshells around her at almost all times. And all of these things came together they led me to taking this online quiz. And the question in the quiz was, is your wife an emotional bully? And there were 15 questions, and 14 of them applied to me. The only one that didn't apply to me did not apply because we did not have children.
Yeah.
When I realized, Alex, that I could now give my condition a name, that's when I began to experience some degree of empowerment. Fortunately, I started going to therapy. My therapist, you know, got me back on track. So the suicidal ideation began to wane, and now I could call my experience something. I could call it what it was. I could call it emotional abuse. And it was then that I began to realize just how much, even in the therapeutic community, the notion of an abused man is sort of laughable, right? I actually had a therapist tell me that men can't be abused. That only,
right.
only women can be abused. So that led me to a level of engagement beyond myself, because I started to see how many other men there may have been in my situation, and how many other men, and how hard it is to speak about something that you can't name. Because there's no shared communication. Language, I think, is at the root of so much of our social experiences. And when we lack the capacity to communicate with others, we remain misunderstood or not understood at all. And that can lead a lot of men to eventually take their own lives. So it became something much bigger than me when I began to think about it in that way. And my university, my soon to be former employer, Walla Walla University, 7 years ago, they had a TED event, and they were soliciting topics from faculty. And so that was a topic that I put out there, and they told me they wanted to hear from me. And I had just filed for divorce at the time. I began to see that there was a way out. So I began to move away from a lot of the conservative religious rhetoric around marriage, because I want to make this point too, Alex. It's important to emphasize this. In religious communities, marriage is rhetorically positioned as a zero-sum game. The man, particularly in Christian communities, the man has to lay himself on the altar as a sacrifice. And if he goes, it's okay as long as his wife and family are okay. And that's a very unhealthy view of the marriage relationship. And I started to move away from that. And I started to see, you know what? There is a way out. And as much as I did not want to do it, I filed for divorce because it became painfully obvious to me that my ex-wife didn't take me seriously. She didn't, when I told her, you know, these abusive episodes about my weight and your lack of attraction to me, all of that has got to stop or else I can't be your husband anymore. I don't think she ever took me seriously. And eventually it got to the point where I said, okay, I don't want to be divorced. But, you know, it's almost like when you go to the doctor, and this happened to my mother. She was diabetic and she had wounds on her feet, on her foot. And the doctor said, you're either going to die with 2 feet or live with one. And my mother said she was going to die with both. And she did. And that's the choice you have to, it's something of a Hobson's choice, right? I'm either going to endure the pain of staying in a relationship that is hurting me, or I'm going to endure the pain of divorce, which will end, which it will hurt, but it will end. And when it's over, I'll have the chance to live a better life. And so I chose the latter, and getting away from that kind of either or black and white, sort of naive fundamentalist way of understanding marriage, did wonders for me. And so I gave the TED Talk. I didn't want to do it. It was very hard to do. I'm a lawyer, right? So I've argued cases in front of judges and juries my whole career. I'm a public speaker. I've spoken at events all across the country, in churches and at banquets and all kinds of things. But in none of those situations have I ever had to be so vulnerable. And the level of vulnerability made that TED Talk very hard to do. But in the end, I'm glad I did it.
I'm glad you did it. I am so glad that you're speaking on this topic. For years now, this topic of, I'm working on another future book called The Battered House Husband, and it's talking about this topic because there's a lot of men out there that are victims of, maybe we call it asymmetrical warfare, where although they may be the physically larger, stronger person, they're in a relationship where they get in the brunt of the emotional abuse. And you know, the fact that it brought you, and I want to make this point for the listeners out there, to the brink of suicide. And that's really the scariest sign as psychiatrists and mental health professionals that we look for, is when someone has a thought of suicide and starts to become happy, starts to feel relief, because the life that they're living is so painful, so sad, so fearful right now, that it would, their conclusion is it would be better to not be alive. That's when suicide is very likely to happen. So we always want to be sensitive to that. And sadly, that's the part where a lot of the patients will not tell you they're having those thoughts, because they don't want you to take that away from them. So I'm glad that you did seek help, and it sounds like you did get the help you needed. And your talk meant so much because it's so unique. I haven't seen many things out there talking about this topic. And you articulate the whole, the religious trauma component of it, the perpetuation with culture. You know, I had a patient tell me that his therapist told him, "Do I think your wife's being manipulative? Yes. Do I think your wife's hurting you? Yes. But it's not abuse." And so there's sort of this gaslighting that goes on, and men are told to be strong, suck it up, take it. But a lot of us are hurting desperately to the point of suicide. So thank you so much for being brave enough to share that.
Yes, Alex, I thank you. I appreciate that. I knew I was in trouble the night when I thought of putting a gun in my mouth and blowing my brains through the top of my head. And I fell asleep with that thought on my mind and a smile on my face. And I knew, even at my level of emotional and psychological dysfunction was so bad that the thought of doing that not only brought a smile to my face, but it also was in some sort of way, a way for me to look out for the well-being of my ex-wife, because I knew that if I killed myself, she would be better off because she would have the sympathy of the entire religious community, that they would rally around her, and that she would be free to remarry because her husband died and her marriage didn't end as a result of divorce, but rather as a result of the death of her spouse. So even at my lowest point, in a very twisted, sort of contorted, dysfunctional way, I saw myself as looking out for her.
Now, I really understand what you're talking about. I was raised in the church in a Methodist spinoff, and I understand that sort of view of, you know, the you sacrifice for your wife like Christ sacrifices for the church. However, now you say you don't quite buy that anymore. You say you've come to the realization that that was a very unhealthy view of the marriage relationship. What is... And is it still Christian? Have you kind of left the faith a bit, or what's the healthy view of the marriage relationship now?
So good. That's a good question. So I still very much see myself as a Christian. I think that the problem in Christian circles, particularly more conservative, fundamentalist oriented Christian circles, is a hermeneutical problem. It's an interpretive problem in theology. So when you study ancient civilizations like those in first century Palestine, for example, where Jesus is talking to Hebrew men who are the religious leaders of the community, who have essentially over the centuries learned to abuse the Mosaic bill of divorcement, right? And what was happening was you had a lot of men who were marrying women to get the dowry, the gift from their father-in-law. And as soon as they got the gift, they would divorce their wives and leave them destitute for frivolous reasons, right? Like,
sure,
she doesn't please me, you know, some amorphous. And this, of course, left many women destitute, right? And of course, this is a situation that leads to oppression. Well, So a lot of the statements about marriage that occur in the Bible occur in that historical context. So,
sure,
for example, there's a passage in Malachi 2, verse 16, that conservative Christians will often quote that says, God hates divorce. But God hates divorce if men are abusing it in that way, right?
Right.
If men are essentially marrying women for their money and living in a society where women have no legal rights at all and are essentially treated as property, if they're marrying them to take what's theirs and then leave them destitute and consign them to lives of prostitution and then condemn them as prostitutes, then of course God doesn't like that. But the problem that I have, right, Alex, are problems with interpretation. So that's in the Old Testament. But if you go over to the New Testament, Paul in Ephesians is writing letters to churches. And he's writing a letter where he says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. I'm astonished that we take hyperbole in a letter in the first century that is written to people at a church in which the men at that church are having a problem because they're likely continuing the abuse of divorce and sort of mistreating their spouses and leaving them destitute. He's writing a letter to people at a specific time who are experiencing a specific problem, and we think that advice is trans-historical.
No way was that meant to be excuse to just accept abuse from a wife for you know, no reason.
Exactly. It isn't the case. I mean, we act like we never use hyperbole. So I think a lot of the statements in the New Testament about marriage, for example, in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, Jesus says that you shouldn't get divorced except for adultery. But we completely forget that he's talking to a group of men who are getting divorced for frivolous reasons, just so that they can enrich themselves at the expense of their wives. So in that context, you might need to restrict their use of divorce. But that doesn't mean that a woman who is being physically beaten can't divorce her husband. It doesn't mean that a man who is emotionally beaten by his wife and at the brink of suicide, it doesn't mean that the man can't divorce his wife. I've always thought that my ex-wife, I have no evidence that she had adultery, and I would never said she committed adultery, and I would never accuse her of committing adultery, right? So I'll never say that about her. But that doesn't mean that when I took my wedding vows, that, which by the way, are not biblical. Wedding vows are not found in the Bible, right? sort of compounded onto it. But I can't imagine that when two people get married, God is contemplating that the promises they make to one another or to God if you're so persuaded to believe in God. I can't imagine that those vows are being made and that they contemplate, you know, even if that a woman is saying to herself, even if my husband is an unrepentant, violent, physically violent and dangerous man, I can't divorce him because he hasn't committed adultery. Right. I doubt very seriously that interpretation of marriage. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And I can't imagine that a man at the altar, when he takes his vows, is saying to himself, you know, no matter how badly she treats me, no matter how much she emasculates me, no matter how badly she talks to me, no matter how hurtful her words are toward me, even if it leads me to the point of taking my own life, I'm not allowed to be divorced because she has not committed adultery. That's not healthy. For me, the healthy view of marriage now is two people who understand that the wedding vows are vows that you take for things that are external to the relationship, right? A terminal illness, loss of a job, a devastating, life-changing injury, right? When you take your wedding vows are things that are oriented externally toward problems to the marriage that are not intrinsic to the marriage, right? That problems that are the kinds of things that happen to all of us in life, and problems that arguably would still demand ethically and morally a commitment despite them. So I'm not going to leave you if you get a protracted illness. I'm not going to leave you if you have a protracted job loss or the income is compromised in some way and it's beyond your control, right? So sure. I think, to me, those things are very healthy. And I think we all go into marriage with the understanding that nobody's perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
I certainly am not perfect. And I did a lot of things that annoyed my ex-wife, and she did a lot of things. She did a lot of things that annoyed me. But that's not why we got divorced, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get, when you get married, you sort of sign up for the idiosyncrasies and the little annoying things about your partner that everybody does. You sign up for those things. What you don't sign up for is the pernicious encroachment of another person onto your self-esteem and your well-being, under the guise of, oh, that's just how she is, or, oh,
right,
okay, or, yes, these things are bad, but they're not abuse. So for me, the healthy view of marriage is recognizing those things, that no one is perfect, but also understanding the importance of both people having boundaries within the marriage that say, these are things that we're not going to do to each other. That if we really love each other, we're not going to hurt each other in these ways.
And you know, folks out there listening, please listen to Tim, because hermeneutics, thinking beneath the surface, thinking more deeply. I think that a reason a lot of guys, or you know, women too, stay in relationships is because of maybe a naive or a false view that if you left the relationship because you are being abused, whether it's physical or emotional, that somehow you're betraying God. For those of the folks that might be steeped in religion, but looking deeper, you know, there can be some freedom there, and that can be one big barrier to get past. Because the analogy that I always go back to is most of the folks in society say, you know, if he hits you once, it's his fault. If he hits you again, it's your fault for staying. That kind of an idea. The basic idea is that it's not acceptable to be physically abusive to your partner. If your partner becomes physically abusive to you, by all means, you should not accept that. You should get away.
However, I don't understand why we have this double standard for emotional abuse, because so many men that I talk to are beat up, emotionally abused, hardcore for years, decades, and they're just told to suck it up. And they said, you know, it's a stigma. A lot of therapists out there will say, like you were told, men can't be abused. It's not emotional abuse. There's a lot of gaslighting going on. And I don't understand why we give this emotional abuse a pass. But I wanted to kind of hone in on a little bit. What would be your definition of emotional abuse? How do I know if I'm being emotionally abused in a relationship, or if I'm just bickering or complaining or blowing things up or exaggerating?
Well, I will say this, Alex, and this is important because it has to do with paying attention to your emotions. And I can't stress this enough. Pay attention to how what your spouse says to you, if we're talking about a marriage relationship, or what your partner, if we're going to broaden it to talk about boyfriends, girlfriends, etc. How do you feel based on what your partner says or does? I think paying attention to your emotions, is what is said, does it make you feel unworthy? Does the other person tend to privilege themselves by talking about all the wonderful things they do and contrast it to your failures? One of the things my ex-wife would do to me is, she's a very attractive woman, and she would say to me things like, "You like what you see when you look at me, so I'm supposed to like what I see when I look at you, and I don't." And she told me, and this was really kind of bizarre, she said, "I'm tired of you giving me compliments." Now, what woman doesn't want their husband to give them compliments, right? I mean, she's my wife, right? "I'm tired of you giving me compliments, because every time you give me a compliment, I'm reminded of how I do my part and how you don't do yours." And how attractive I am to you, but you're not to me. And you have to, so I would just say, number one is you have to pay attention to how you feel. This isn't so much a definition as it is maybe some telltale signs, right?
Gotcha.
Does the person make you feel bad? And does the person make you feel bad consistently, right? Is it a consistent issue? I would also say that in addition to feeling bad, does your partner have two faces? Is there a public face to your partner? And is that public face contrasted with a private face? My ex-wife was famous for singing my praises in front of people. And
right.
When it was just the two of us, it would be the total opposite. And that's a way of, and I guess the second point is, make sure that you're not kept off balance. And when I say that, what I mean is, there were times for me when privately I would be raked over the coals, but publicly I was the best thing since sliced bread. And so when something bad happened to me privately and I might confide in a friend, the friend would automatically say, "Oh no, man, she loves you. Didn't you hear how she was talking about you? Didn't you see her face lit up?" And in that moment, now I'm being gaslit, right?
Yeah.
Now I'm questioning if what I'm experiencing is really even happening to me, right? And it's just being kept off balance. And here's what was even worse was that what my ex-wife would do is when she spoke to other people about my weight and my physical appearance, she did it in the name of my health. But when she spoke to me about it privately, she did it in the name of sexuality. And
yeah.
spoke about how unattractive I was to her. She told me that she was repulsed by me. She told me that, again, I think I said this in the TED Talk, that until I got on a scale in front of her naked and lost weight, that I was, that we were going to be celibate, right? And so, number one, I would say pay attention to how you feel. Number two, ask yourself, are you being kept off balance? And that sort of goes hand in hand with the first one. And number three, I would say, when you try to talk to your spouse or your partner about it, your significant other, what is their reaction? Right?
Yeah.
What is their reaction? Because an abusive person, particularly someone who has a very high opinion of themselves, well, those folks do not take well to criticism. And if you said, like I did eventually to my ex-wife, hey, you know, what you're doing is really hurting me. And I really want you to stop doing that. If the response is to double down and gaslight you further and carry on and say you're making a big deal out of nothing, that is a telltale sign that you're experiencing emotional abuse. So
I would agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah. I would say those three things. One, pay attention to how you feel. Two, ask yourself if you're being kept off balance. Is there, because again, most abusers, they have two faces. They have a public face where they will sing your praises, and then they have a private face with you where they will effectively undermine everything they've said about you publicly and make you feel like the worst person in the world. And number three, how does the person react when you bring your feelings to their attention? Are they going to just dismiss you, or are they going to, with some contrition and repentance, say, you know, I'm really sorry. And by the way, an apology is not enough. The apology has to be accompanied by a commitment to refrain from whatever behavior it is going forward. Because no matter how many times you apologize, if you keep doing it, it doesn't really matter. So I would say those three things are I think, some telltale signs that I experienced and I think might apply across the board to others also.
Right. You know, it's so easy for us to say, you know, you get physically abused once, say never again, never again. This cannot happen again. And if it happens again, you know, you're gone, whatever. But when it comes to emotional abuse, thousands of times it keeps happening. And this goes back to sort of this idea of this asymmetric warfare where, you know, just historically through cultures, the weaker sex, you know, so-called physically smaller, there's been developed these tactics often used, and they can be used either way. Men can use them against women can use them against men, but they are often used by women against men. And you've named a few of these tactics and they are powerful. These tactics are used because they're useful. They work. They are effective. They know how to figure out those emotional buttons to push, to find out those weak areas. And they cut you to the soul. And you also brought up the abuse cycle where you weren't being abused every day, 24/7. There were periods, there were lulls, things were going nice, right? There's these periods where the abuse is intermittent, which makes it even a little bit more nefarious because, you know, it keeps you on your toes, keeps you off center.
And oftentimes after a little bit of a phase of abuse, the abuser will go into a love bombing phase, and they'll be the sweetest, most loving person publicly into your face to get you to buy back into the relationship before they start the cycle over again. Did you experience some of the love bombing as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Some episodes of abuse were really, really bad, followed by episodes of really intense sexual behavior, right? And the very thing I was told I wasn't good at, or I didn't attract her, those things became prominent, right, behind closed doors. And then you sort of buy into it, right? You start to, well, gee, okay, well, if it's going to be like this, then this is great, you know? But then you realize as time passes that it's not that great, because that was just, as you put it, to get you to buy in, and it worked. That worked on me for a long time. But then I got to the point where I had to ask myself, what am I buying into? You know, what is the real value of recommitting, or continuing to commit, I should say, to a relationship that is fundamentally painful to me, that's hurting me? You know, I never asked my ex-wife to be perfect. Never. I would never demand that of anybody. All I asked her to do was stop hurting me. And when I realized that she didn't even believe that she was hurting me, I mean, the last words she said to me were, "You're making a big deal out of nothing." And when I heard that, and when she heard my concern coming from a man who she was married to, that had told her about my suicidal ideation, and she knew how harmful and how painful those things were, and for her to say that to me, it just told me everything I needed to know. Because if she is unable to see me as in pain after all of this, she'll never be able to see me. Because the only thing worse than this is me following through with my suicide, right? And then I won't be around to challenge any of her characterizations or assertions or anything. And so, yeah, that's how I began to critically understand what it was going to mean to continue to stay in the marriage, because it was not going to change.
You know, so many of the men that I talk to about this, they've been in these relationships for years. Now, Tim's obviously very intelligent, a great example of someone who thinks deeply, accomplished, philosophical, you know. And how was it that you were sort of stuck in this dynamic for so long? For a lot of the folks I talk to, when it comes to the emotional side, when it comes to ourselves and our relationships, it's almost like we have these sort of blind spots and we can't see clearly, whereas we could see it a mile away if it was someone else. For you, what took so long to kind of wake up to realize that you didn't have to live with this anymore?
Yeah, for me, it was, honestly, Alex, it was cutting through the layer upon layer of religious influence. Essentially told me that I was going to be ostracized if I divorced my wife. The spiritual obligation, the sense of spiritual obligation and Christian obligation that I felt to my ex-wife literally kept me in that marriage all those years. And it made the marriage even worse, because I could sense that I was being gaslit I knew we had friends who could, like you said, we had friends who could see it a mile away. When mm-hmm. I told a friend of mine that I was getting divorced, he said to me, "What took you so long?" We could all tell. But
right.
I was genuinely committed to a dysfunctional Christian understanding of marriage that I think is based on interpretations of the Bible that are just really, really bad interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, if I wrote you a letter today, Alex, suppose I sent you an email today and you said, you know, Tim, I ate this tomato sauce last night and I had indigestion all night, heartburn. And I wrote you back. I wrote an email back to you and said, don't eat tomato sauce, you know, anymore. And 2,000 years from now, somebody sees that email and they extrapolate from that conversation a doctrine that says eating tomato sauce is evil. And no one will eat tomato sauce, right? Completely
right.
Taking the document out of context, completely taking the remarks out of context. And that's what too many theologians and Christian theologians and pastors do. They badly, badly decontextualize and dehistoricize the scriptures in ways that result in very, very unhealthy understandings of marriage that are harmful, very, very harmful to women, very harmful to women. Mm-hmm. Many a woman has been told by many a pastor, "I know he's hitting you, but as long as he's not committing adultery, you have to stay married. I know he's disrespectful to you, brother, but you have to stay in that marriage because she's not committing adultery." That's what the Bible right. says. And it really is a very, very poor, bad, simple-minded view of the scriptures. We take this view sometimes in Christian communities that as long as it says it in the Bible, without any regard for context or history. And I find that astonishing, Alex, and I don't want to go too far afield with this, but I do want to suggest to the Christians who are listening, remember that history is essential to the gospel. So if you're a Christian and you're listening to this, remember that the central feature of Christian doctrine is that God, who is supposed to be ahistorical, outside of history, outside of time, enters into time and into history in the person of Jesus Christ in order to save people, right? That's the belief. If God is that attentive to history and we are supposed to emulate God, then what kind of interpretations of scripture are we rendering to others when those interpretations ignore history altogether? And I think there's a basic principle that my Christian brothers and sisters who are listening can appropriate. And that is that if paying attention to history brings salvation, then ignoring history will always bring oppression and bondage. And the way the scriptures are interpreted as it relates to marriage in such an ahistorical, unhealthy way that doesn't pay attention to context, that has brought nothing but misery and oppression. So Christian folks, I think, need to take heed to that.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I think it applies to lots of religious folks out there because these things are kind of ubiquitous. Now, we've been focusing on the doctrines, the history, the teachings, the philosophy of Christianity and religion and how that can keep people locked into these unhealthy relationships, these abusive, emotionally abusive relationships. Our podcast is very interested in the emotions too. And what I've noticed is that your emotions and the way that the church used your emotions kept you trapped for a long time. And I also noticed how your emotions helped to set you free too. Because when you were trapped, you talked about having this fear of ostracization, fear of being shamed, fear of being lonely, fear of painful emotions. that the church was really wielding to keep you in line, to keep you to follow the rules that they wanted you to follow, so to speak. And then it was also the emotion of relief that you discovered that you were so miserable and in following the rules, following Christ's examples, as you understood at that point, that you felt this emotion of relief at the thought of suicide, which also must have been quite frightening too. So that emotion of fear came back too. And that's what, if I understand, kind of led you to seek a therapist who could help you see things. And through validating your true emotions, validating the pain, validating the misery that was being inflicted upon you, your emotions helped to set you free. And through that lens, you were able to look more deeply at the Christian teachings and see, like, a lot of these doctrines and dogmas are actually not right.
Yeah, that's right. And I love the way you put that, Alex, because you pointed to a fascinating dichotomy with the emotions, that on one hand, they could be manipulated to keep me in bondage, but on the other hand, they could manumit me. They could set me free, so to speak. And if I could just take that point that you made and go a little deeper with that, I think the difference between my emotions being used against me and my emotions being used in my best interest lies in the difference between outsourcing my emotional well-being to others and reclaiming that emotional well-being for myself. We live in a world today where it is convenient to outsource things, to delegate, and we should never relinquish the power of our emotions to anyone else, to any person, to any entity, to any institution. And because when we do that, we are sort of setting ourselves up to be manipulated in ways that can take us to the brink of suicide, as it did me.
Yeah.
What saved me was, and I like to think of it almost as the difference between being codependent on one hand, in which you say to yourself, which you say, okay, well, I'm going to chase down this person for approval. I'm going to live for approval no matter what. And this is what I'm going to do. And I'm just not going to have any emotional boundaries, right? Like, I'm going to let you in and you are going to be able to manage my emotions for me. And when you do that, you end up managing me. And that happens not only with me, it happened with a person and an institution that were sort of combined into one. But I think the much healthier way to approach it is to have boundaries, because what I began to see was that when I began to set boundaries with my ex-wife, I started to feel better about myself. This isn't quite right, what's happening to me.
Yeah.
It's time that I put my foot down. And so that was really a reclamation project. I was taking back, literally taking back and assuming responsibility for my own well-being. And I don't think we should ever outsource that to anyone. A lot of guys do this with women at the beginning stages of relationships. A woman tells a guy she's not interested, rather than take her at her word and walk away. Or sometimes women communicate indirectly, right? And she might not come out and tell you she's not interested, but you realize you're the only one texting, you're the only one calling. And one of my buddies said to me recently, man, I wish she would just tell me. And I said, why would you give her that much power over you? Right? Why would you relinquish your emotional well-being like that to another person? If she's not calling you, if she's not texting you, if she's not expressing any interest, you have to claim your own emotional well-being and say, you know what? Okay, yes, I can read the tea leaves and I can move on. And so I think that point you made is really powerful. Emotions, in a sense, are like the law. The law can put you in bondage and the law can set you free, right? It depends on what's happening in each of those scenarios. So I think it's important to never relinquish your emotions to anyone else, because when you do that, you're setting yourself up for an oppressive, miserable relationship. But if you retain your emotional well-being by setting healthy boundaries at the beginning, now all of a sudden you're much less inclined to fall into the trap of being manipulated, because you're not giving people who aren't worthy of your emotional investment access to who you are emotionally. I like to think that anybody who lives in my head is paying rent, right?
Right. Anybody, there we go.
Anybody who I'm thinking about or who I'm emotionally invested in is doing something, in a sense, something similar for me.
I think of a very useful definition of boundaries to think of them as preferences, or even another subcategory of emotions: desires, preferences, wishes. And when you start to validate your own emotions by asserting what you prefer, you know, I prefer that you not call me that mean name that makes me feel like shit. That would be nice, right?
Yeah.
And that's such a great way to assert yourself, to express yourself, to be known and to validate your emotional truth. You know, I don't like that. I do like this. I don't like it when you do that. I love it when you do this. And I'm so glad that you use that word reclaim. It took over a month for my publisher and myself to come up with the subtitle for the book. And my publisher suggested the word reclaim, which became the subtitle of Reclaim Yourself with the 5 Steps of Radical Emotional Acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And it just really resonated, this idea of so many of us are lost. So many of us, we're not in touch with our emotions. We're not in touch with the emotional truth of our happy emotions, our sad emotions, our scary emotions, and our preferences, our boundaries, our desires. And if we can start to validate and really get in touch with our emotional truth, our emotional data, that's the pathway back to happiness. And I mean, I'm going out on a wild limb here and saying, you seem like you're a lot happier now. You seem like you're very satisfied that you have done this work yourself. You seem like you're not regretting the decision you made.
No, I don't regret it, Alex. It was probably the best decision I should have ever made. It hurt. It was painful. I'm not here to pretend that, and I'm not here to tell everybody to run out and be divorced, but because divorce is hard, right? It's painful, and it brought a lot of sadness, a lot of grief, a lot of pain. Fortunately, I've had a good therapist. I've done a lot of work on my own traumas, both from childhood, and a lot of trauma that was inflicted during the marriage, frankly, was really bad. And I've worked through those and spent lots of lonely nights. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia. And when I moved to Walla Walla, Washington, I moved from the Philadelphia area. I left my home, my friends, my family. My acting career was just starting and to take off. And I walked away from all of that because I knew there was one fundamental truth that I could not get over, and that was that I could not be married and be healthy at the same time. Mm-hmm. That if I was going to stay married, I was also going to stay unhealthy. And that if I was going to be healthy, then it meant that my marriage had to end. And so when I got to that point and I saw that my well-being and the continuation of my marriage were fundamentally incompatible with each other, then I decided to choose my health. And I'm so glad I did. My divorce will be final, I guess, for 7 years in a couple of months. And the 7 years has been 7 years of healing, of pain, a lot of grief, a lot of suffering. But I'm here to tell you that if you're a person out there who's listening to this and you're suffering from emotional abuse, and whether you're a woman or a man, but especially to the men, because the culture tells us not to express ourselves and to just go along to get along, I'm here to tell you, to the men listening, there is life on the other side. There is life on the other side. You will wake up and it will be a new day. The sun will rise. The birds will sing. The trees will sway in the breeze. And you will be glad that you made the decision that you made. So I hope that's some encouragement for those who are listening.
Beautiful message. It's been so great having you on. I've got 1,000 more questions we didn't get to. This message is so essential. It needs to get out there more. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Where can folks follow you? Can they listen to you on the Motown Philly podcast? What's going on?
Yes. So you can certainly listen to me and my co-host Jason Hall on the Motown Philly podcast. It is found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all of podcast hosting platforms. At our podcast, we talk about communication, connection, and community. That's our mantra. And if you don't mind listening to a couple of two black men, one from Detroit, one from Philly, talk about emotions and well-being and mental health and all those wonderful things, by all means, subscribe to our podcast there. If you share our podcast on social media, use the hashtag Motown Philly, and I think that you'll enjoy that. You can find me on Instagram at A Good Golden Man. You can find me on Twitter at DRTJGoldenESQ. And you can also find me on Facebook at Tim Golden. And I'm probably the only Tim Golden in Walla Walla, Washington. So Tim, if you look there, you'll find me there too. But Alex, thank you so much for having me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And I'm hoping that I get to come back so you can ask the other questions that you said you had. So I'm excited about that. And we would love to have you as a guest on the Motown Philly podcast to talk about your work and your book and all that sort of good stuff. So I will be in touch about that. Thank you so much for having me, Alex. And to those who are listening, thank you for listening. And there is hope. I am living proof of it.
By the time this podcast airs, the audiobook version of Give a F Actually will be released. So that's our exciting news. I will definitely be on your podcast if you guys will have me. Yeah. And if you guys haven't checked out Dr. Tim Golden's TED Talk, amazing, amazing stuff.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Hey guys, thanks for watching. This is Dr. Alex Wills with Give a F Actually. Make sure to check us out on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts.
Thanks for watching. Make sure to check out the merch store, RadicalEmotionalAcceptance.com. Bye.
Bye.